Yosef is well integrated in the top tier of Egyptian society. He most likely also finds himself participating in its culture and absorbing its values. All of this is one facet of his identity. At the same time, Yosef constantly carries within himself a mental picture of his father's house and his Hebrew identity. Welcome to Parsha and Politics, Parshat Miketz, The Tears of Joseph, The Journey of Judah, and the Insights of Rabbi Aharon Lichtenstein. I'm Meir Soloveitchik.
Welcome to Parsha and Politics, How Torah Changed the World. This series is brought to you by MeirSoloveitchik.com, a project of Tikva. If you'd like to learn more with Rabbi Soloveitchik, we invite you to subscribe at MeirSoloveitchik.com. This week's episode is dedicated to Tzvi Aryeh ben Necha Zissel.
In 1956, a young Talmudic scholar by the name of Aharon Lichtenstein met Robert Frost in Vermont. Frost, by then a world-famous poet, surely did not have a full appreciation of the caliber of the young man that stood before him. For Rabbi Aharon Lichtenstein would be one of the greatest rabbinical scholars of his time, a leader of Yeshivat HaRatzion in Israel, and a brilliant expositor of the Talmudic method of his father-in-law, Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik. That Rabbi Lichtenstein sought out Frost highlighted the rabbi's own love of English literature, a subject in which he received a doctorate. While Torah study was, above all, his spiritual and intellectual occupation, Rabbi Lichtenstein would often illustrate how his study of literature broadened his spiritual horizons and how it could do the same for his students. In one extraordinary episode, he delivered an entire lecture in yeshiva on Frost's poem Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening, actually translating the entire poem in his own hand into Hebrew in order that his Israeli students could engage the words of the Vermont literary light. Of all of Rabbi Lichtenstein's literature-inspired reflections on the Torah, perhaps the most moving is his analysis of the identity of Joseph, or, in Hebrew, Yosef. Utilizing the verses that Rabbi Lichtenstein cites and his own brilliant interpretation of them, we will attempt to understand the struggle that takes place within Yosef and what this tells us about the contrast between Yosef and Yehuda, or Judah, the other critical character in our tale. For Rabbi Lichtenstein, the literary key to understanding Yosef can be found in his tears, for this is a man who will weep more than most figures found in the Bible. The weeping, as will be revealed, will provide insight into the struggle that surges in Yosef's soul. Let us briefly summarize the early events of the parasha. Pharaoh experiences two dreams, each with a similar theme. Seven sheaves of glorious grain are suddenly swallowed by paltry ones, and then seven healthy cows are devoured by seven emaciated animals of the same species. Pharaoh's minister of drinks recalls a young Hebrew in prison with a gift for dream interpretation, and Yosef is summarily summoned. The Hebrew youth explains that the dreams both predict 7 years of sustenance followed by seven of famine, and he advises the ruler of Egypt to prepare for what is yet to come. Incredibly impressed by the young man, Pharaoh promotes him to vizier and bestows a new name upon the former prisoner and sudden statesman, Tzafnat Paneach, the revealer of what is hidden. This indicates that Yosef has a new Egyptian identity, and the name bestowed upon his eldest child, Menashe, similarly signals that he has left his past behind. The root of the name Menashe is forgetting, and Yosef seeks to forget his unpleasant familial past. As he says, "For God has allowed me to forget my troubles and my father's household." At this moment, Yosef seems eager to forget who he once was, and the sign of this forgetting is his placidity. As Rabbi Lichtenstein notes, Yosef is too successful and unchallenged to weep, too engaged in politics to ponder his past, even as there is turmoil yet to come. Rabbi Lichtenstein writes, quote, "Under these circumstances, severance from homeland and family, occupation with steering an empire through its challenges, building his household and family, a day-to-day reality of impressive achievements, a sense of strength and power that provides him enormous satisfaction, there is no one and nothing that causes Yosef to weep. It is only when he comes face to face with his brothers again that he wants and needs to weep. On some occasions when Yosef is unable to hold himself back, his tears burst forth. In these encounters, all of the feelings that have been suppressed and submerged rise up again. All that has been forgotten floods back into his consciousness." End quote. When the famine comes, this turmoil is about to begin. Joseph's brothers end up in Egypt, seeking sustenance on behalf of themselves and their elderly father, standing before a powerful personage who, unbeknownst to them, is the half-brother that they betrayed. Suddenly, we are told, Yosef remembered the dreams which he had dreamt about them. This is no mere remembrance, as Rabbi Lichtenstein explains, quote, "Yosef remembers not only the dreams, but also everything that came with them, the atmosphere within which they had appeared, and the chain of events they brought in their wake," end quote. Yosef demands from his brethren that they return to the Holy Land and bring back Benjamin, the other son of Jacob's beloved Rachel, Yosef's full brother. Until they return, one of them, Jacob's second son, Simeon Shimon, would be held hostage. The brothers, bewildered, take their leave of Joseph and ponder why God brought such a bizarre and terrible turn of events. This is our parasha. Then they said to one another, "But in truth we are guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the distress of his soul when he besought us, and we would not listen. Therefore is this distress come upon us." The brothers see in their plight providential punishment for what they did to Joseph. As they speak, they have no idea that they are understood by the apparently Egyptian vizier. At this point, something stirs within Yosef. We are told he turned away from them and wept. This, for Rabbi Lichtenstein, is a sign of more weeping yet to come, a reflection that the man who was apparently placid until now has a sudden surge of emotions within him. Rabbi Lichtenstein writes, quote, "This encounter opens a Pandora's box. Yosef is waging a battle not only with his brothers, but also with himself, with his past, present, and future." So Rabbi Lichtenstein writes, and in a mesmerizing melding of Torah and literature, Rabbi Lichtenstein reflects on what Joseph's tears reveal. Quote, "The great Irish writer W.B. Yeats said that, 'We make out of the quarrel with others rhetoric, but of the quarrel with ourselves poetry.' The world of poetry," he maintains, "is the pure, refined world of emotion, a world in which weeping, whether external or internal, is granted a place of honor. This world is something Yosef cannot escape." So Rabbi Lichtenstein writes, "And the weeping, in other words, marks a quarrel within Yosef, a quarrel as to who he is, who he is called to be. The brothers despondently return to Canaan and report to Jacob that the Egyptian vizier has demanded that Benjamin return with them. The elderly patriarch refuses to send Benjamin to Egypt, as he is the only remaining son of Rachel. We are told by the Torah what Jacob said to them. Atem yidatem ki shnayim yoldu li ishti. You know that only two were born to me by my wife." How Jacob's words must have stung. It is the mother of Joseph and Benjamin, that is, my wife, with the mothers of all his other children, seemingly consigned to secondary status. All of the hatred and jealousy directed against Joseph could so easily have found a new target in Benjamin, but it does not. And it does not because of the other main character in the story. And we must briefly review the tale of this other endlessly fascinating figure. It was Judah who, in last week's reading, had suggested selling Joseph. We were then told that following this betrayal of his brother, Judah had left his larger family entirely, distancing himself from his brethren, raising his children elsewhere. When his eldest son died because of moral wickedness, Judah's daughter-in-law Tamar was given Judah's second son as a husband in fulfillment of levirate marriage. This son was similarly punished for wickedness by God, and with Tamar a widow again, Judah dishonestly promised her his third son, Shelah, but did not allow the marriage to go forward. Unable to marry anyone else, Tamar, in the guise of a prostitute, met Judah and was propositioned by him. She demanded of Judah an eravon, a collateral, ensuring his ultimate payment. He said, "What collateral shall I give you?" She replied, "Your signet and your cord and your staff that is in your hand." So he gave them to her. A pregnancy resulted. The society in which they lived assumed that the pregnancy indicated that Tamar had had illicit relations, and Tamar is brought before the regional court. It is at this point that Tamar produced the collateral she had been given. The Torah tells us in last week's reading, "As she was being brought out, she sent word to her father-in-law, saying, 'By the man to whom these belong, I am with child.' And she said, 'Recognize, please, whose these are, the signet and the cord and the staff.'" As we noted in Bible 365, Tamar hit upon the exact words that stabbed most deeply and sharply at Judah's conscience. For these, as many noted, were the exact words that he and his brothers had used in presenting the blood-soaked, colorful coat of Yosef to their father. "Recognize this, please." Judah suddenly realized all the wrong that had occurred because of him.
I hope you're enjoying this exploration of the Parsha's political wisdom. You can continue learning with Rabbi Soloveitchik at meirsoloveitchik.com, where you'll find a growing Torah library of online video courses, essays, and his two daily podcasts, Bible 365, a year-long study of the entire Tanakh, and Jerusalem 365, which explores the 4,000-year history of the Jewish people's eternal capital in a single year.
Recognizing the collateral before the court and absolving Tamar, again last week's reading, "Then Judah acknowledged them and said, 'She is more righteous than I, inasmuch as I did not give her to my own son Shelah.'" This moment seems to have produced a total moral transformation in Judah. He recognized not only the collateral that he gave Tamar, but also that he needed to act as collateral for his family. His repentance would take place through his being responsible for them. We can now return to our reading, where Judah is back with his brothers, a sign that he has wholly joined his family once more. When Jacob is reluctant to send Benjamin to Egypt, Judah, who quite literally once sold Yosef down the river, now pledges himself for his other half-brother. And Judah said to Israel his father, "Send the lad with me, and we will arise and go, that we may live and not die, both we and you and also our little ones. I will be collateral for him. Of my hand you shall require him." Thus does the very same Judah who had betrayed one half-brother pledge himself to another. What we find here is complete repentance, so that by the time he is back in Egypt, he seems to be the leader of the brothers. Judah's pledge on behalf of Benjamin has somehow fostered a sense of communion with the entire family, and he reflects the Talmudic principle that all Jews are collateral for one another. Benjamin is brought by the brothers before Yosef, and another urge for emotional expression erupts. We are told, "Yosef hastened, for he felt compassion towards his brother, and he wanted to weep. So he entered his chamber and wept there." Whereas Yosef originally had turned aside to weep, here he hurries from the room. For Rabbi Lichtenstein, this is significant. He writes, "The element of compassion, the inner emotional bond that contrasts so starkly with the royal role that Yosef plays in Egypt, rises up all at once and with great power. He heads from the vestibule to the hall. The move expresses more than just a physical, geographical transition from one place to another. It is a transition from one level of existence to another one, from the external world to the inner world, the world of home." In this discussion, the great Talmudic sage introduces another fascinating element from his study of English literature. He writes, "Elizabethan theater in England featured two stages. First, there was a vestibule, an outer room, an external stage, where public events would take place. The rhetoric, to employ Yeats's term. Then there was an inner, more intimate stage, where man's tragic struggles would be played out in the form of the drama taking place within the hero himself. When Shakespeare's Juliet declares, 'My dismal scene I needs must act alone,' she passes from the outer stage to the inner one. Her declaration accompanies her transition. 'He entered his chamber,' then, is the dismal scene that Yosef needs must act alone. Here, in the inner chamber, he gives expression to his tragic conflict, to his explosion of emotion. Yosef, we are told, washes his face before returning. This washing, Rabbi Lichtenstein argues, must be literarily understood. Yosef weeps as an Israelite, as Benjamin's brother, but that aspect of his identity must be washed clean as he stands before his brothers again. Or as Rabbi Lichtenstein puts it, Yosef must compose himself and rearrange his official mask. When he leaves the chamber, his face washed and his demeanor composed, he is once again Safnat Paneach, the revealer of secrets, viceroy over Egypt." So Rabbi Lichtenstein writes, and the weeping, he explains, finally allows us to understand the genuine battle of identity within. As he puts it, it speaks to the chasm between his inner being and his external appearance, all the more so because the external appearance is not merely play-acting and reflects a genuine aspect of Yosef's existence in Egypt. Politically, his success is meteoric. Economically, too, he prospers. He serves as both foreign minister and finance minister. He has an Egyptian wife, and his children grow up like any other aristocratic Egyptians. Yosef is well integrated in the top tier of Egyptian society. He most likely also finds himself participating in its culture and absorbing its values. All of this is one facet of his identity. At the same time, Yosef constantly carries within himself a mental picture of his father's house and his Hebrew identity. End quote. Yosef, in other words, confronts a question that will address itself to many figures in Jewish history. Who am I, and what is the essence of my identity? The weekly reading ends with a cliffhanger. Yosef frames Benjamin and declares that the boy will be his slave. But we know what happens next. Judah steps forward and asks to be taken instead, declaring that he is collateral for his brother. Stunned, Yosef bursts into tears and identifies himself weeping upon his brothers. But the brothers, stunned, draw back, as indicated by Yosef's plea at this moment. "Please, come near me." Despite Joseph's heroic forgiveness, full communion has not been achieved. The plea, Rabbi Lichtenstein reflects, indicates what is to come. The years of distance, the shameful memory of what they had done to Yosef, and Yosef's position of power will ensure that the brothers will not be fully bonded with Yosef while he is still alive. Or as Rabbi Lichtenstein puts it, it becomes clear to Yosef the terrible price he has paid for his success, for his integration into Egyptian culture, for all of his restraint. Yosef stands alone. Even once he has decided to emerge from his isolation, to put an end to his alienation, those around him remain alienated from him. It is only now that Yosef discovers what he has sacrificed in exchange for the power that he has accumulated, for being the ruler over all of Egypt, for presuming to be the one to feed, nourish, command, and sustain. End quote. Yosef's political genius, his gift for statecraft in the court of Pharaoh, creates a chasm between him and his brothers that will never be fully bridged. By the end of Genesis, Jacob will reveal on his deathbed that the future of political leadership will not lie with Joseph. He says, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah." In the end, the Jewish leader must embody a sense of communion with the Jewish people and have that sense reciprocated. And that is Judah's legacy. The story of Joseph and Judah speaks to us profoundly in our particular time. There is no question that many Jews have suddenly been stirred to ponder their own roots. However different their own story is from that of Joseph, they are also asking themselves, who am I and what is the essence of my identity? It is intriguing to wonder, as I believe I have seen other writers reflect, whether there will be Herzls or Jabotinskys that will emerge from this moment. Meanwhile, our reading also asks us how we will help cultivate the leadership of the future. For the truly great Jewish leader must combine the gifts of both Joseph and Judah, joining a deep and sophisticated understanding of world affairs with a heroic sense of communion with and responsibility for the present and posterity of the Jewish people. Seeking the melding of Joseph and Judah is the great task of our time. This is Meir Soloveitchik, wishing you a luminous and meaningful Chanukah and a Shabbat Shalom, signing off.